Anytime we take the time to become aware of other, it enhances our lives and the lives of those around us, I believe. Today's guest is Elliot Stein, author of Custodians of Wonder. Join us as we open that door. I'm Robin Clare with Tributaries. When I originally saw the book, Custodians of Wonder, it was kind of like you had me at hello. I didn't know really what was in the book, but I think you are one of our major custodians of wonder.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say, but I assure you I'm just a guy. I think the real joy and the real magic of the book is obviously in the custodians themselves and their backstories, the many hundreds of years behind each tradition. So I was just there to quietly listen.
Yes. I'd like to start with a quote from the introduction of Custodians of Wonder. In an age when everything has seemingly been explored and explained, and where cynicism so often overshadows curiosity and wonder, these cultural custodians remind us how much there is still to discover and invites us to fall back in love with the world. So that's why I was thinking you are definitely a custodian of wonder, because you acknowledge that. You know, in thinking about doing an interview, there are so many angles all the time, right, that can be covered. So I started thinking about the psychology behind all of these things and the people. But then what really clicked for me was the actual story. And by trying to take it into some psychological babble or insights into the culture of it all, that's kind of how curiosity does get lost and the wonder gets lost.
Yeah, I agree. I think by going about our daily rhythms, we're often so tunnel visioned and kind of looking forward and not really aware of all the things that we kind of sleepwalk past in any given day. And that those are quiet moments, but those are also things that I think have history that have shaped us in quiet, subtle ways. And I think I was just really trying to awaken readers to the fact that no matter where we live, whether it's in Boulder, whether it's in Kathmandu, or whether it's a mountainous village in the Sardinian Highlands, we each have these things that have shaped us in different ways and also made us the people that we are and made the places that we come from the places that they are. And these can take many, many different forms. But as you say, each of them have a story. So whether it's a night watchman or a craftsmaker or someone who's kind of quietly going about their job in a humble, unassuming way, they're each contributing to these things. And I was just trying to point a little bit of attention their way.
Yes. Well, I like how in your book you do cover all of those various aspects of culture and what really creates us as humans and as a race. And we're being a little bit nebulous right now because I'm sure some of these people listening have no idea about your book, Custodians of Wonder. So why don't you walk us through one of the chapters, how you found this person, what they did, and how, as a writer, you approach telling their story?
Sure. So the book is a collection of 10 of the world's rarest and most dazzling cultural marvels on the edge of disappearance, as told by the last people alive preserving them. So it's 10 stories, 5 continents, and each chapter takes place in a different destination. And it's everything from the last Inca bridge master who balances precariously over a gorge every year to weave the last remaining Inca suspension bridge from the empire with his bare hands. It's 3 women who live atop a mountain in central Sardinia who have tightly guarded the secret recipe of making the world's rarest pasta. And the only way that you're able to eat it is to complete a 33-kilometer overnight pilgrimage to a rural sanctuary. It is the unlikely story of a 27th generation West African griot who no longer lives in West Africa, and how he is guarding this ancient sacred instrument that is still revered by 13 million Mande people in 9 countries in West Africa. And another example is a family of alchemists who live on the banks of a river in southern India, in the state of Kerala, who have been tightly guarding this mysterious recipe for a metal mirror that is rumored to reveal your truest self. So I've been doing this for about 7 years, kind of traveling around the globe, profiling these people and spending weeks at a time shadowing them. And to your good question of how the stories come about, there's no one way exactly. Some of these are places that I've lived previously. Some of them are places that I've read about in passing over the years and sort of kept in kind of a mental Rolodex of things that I'd like to report if and when I have the time. I created a column for the BBC many years ago all about this, and this is what inspired the book. I reported stories very similar to these, kind of in the same vein of Final Custodians, that seemed to resonate with a lot of people, and one of the stories won a pretty big award, and so that led to a book deal. And so for this book, I created seven new stories, and there's three of the stories that I have expanded from their previous small iterations. I'd go back to the destination. I would spend another week or so with the custodian and really flesh those stories out. But I guess in somewhat similar to the custodians themselves, for me, this was really a labor of love. That's something that I wanted to give to them, because their work is often unheralded. These are humble individuals living modest lives. You know, you don't get people from across the globe coming to talk to them very often. So it's something I wanted to give them, and I think just something that I think that we all needed as a people right now, given the climate and sort of where we are right now in the world.
Yes, and it's funny, as you're saying that, it made me think of how the name Tributaries came up for my radio show / podcast, because I felt the same way. People who were working on the outer edge of alternatives, whether it be medicine or spiritual thought or choreography, whatever it may be, they're part of what feeds into this great ocean of who we are. And Tributaries also had that word tribute in there. And I really felt like people like yourself who are doing these things, we want to know them. We want to know about these things so it can really enlarge our perspective. And, you know, if we're thinking in a certain 2-inch parameter, if we hear something that's outside the box, that's going to increase a little bit, right? On the left or right, it's going to go to 2.5.
Yeah, it's a really lovely idea. I've never thought of the word tributaries like that, but I think you've touched on something important, which is just we need these people. And I'm not talking about myself here, but these people who are kind of quietly contributing and making the world a more diverse, fascinating, interesting place. I think that we can all learn from them by turning our attention their way. They're the ones who are really keeping places what they are and maintaining their identity. And they often go unheralded and kind of ignored, but I think that we owe these folks a lot.
Which story was it that got you the award, that got you the book deal, that brought us together talking today?
So it's actually one that doesn't appear in the book. It was from my column. It was another story in Sardinia, and that's why it doesn't appear in the book. You know, when you only have 10 stories, you want to cast a pretty wide geographical and thematic net.
Yes.
I was really just trying to show humanity, right? And so humanity is not 5 countries in Europe out of 10 or 5 stories in the U.S. It's really spreading things across the world. Culinary stories, musical stories, artistic stories, etc. So this was one in Sardinia. It was a 20th generation sea silk seamstress. She's the last woman on earth who is believed to know how to dive into the ocean, harvest a very rare endangered Mediterranean mollusk with the tips of her fingers, bring it to the surface, and then weave it into elaborate shapes that glisten like gold. So the fabric is actually called byssus. You know, it was used by Mesopotamians to weave clothing for their kings. It was used to dress pharaohs. It was believed to be the material that God commanded Moses to drape on the tabernacle. And so she's the last woman alive who knows how to do this. And she maintains a one-room studio on an island off the coast of Sardinia where she still does this.
And did you just randomly bump into her? How did you become aware of this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I used to live in Sardinia for quite a few years and have written some guidebooks about Sardinia. You know, I heard whispers about her during my time there on the island. And after I left, I came back to finally get to know her. And, you know, it was a pretty spiritual experience. She goes to a secluded cove every evening where women and her family have prayed for hundreds and hundreds of years and kind of goes into a shamanic chant. And I watched her do that. I watched her weave at the loom that has been in her family for 200 years and watched her concoct these dyes out of flowers and berries and other mollusks. It was a pretty surreal experience. In kind of whittling down the stories, you have so much from the cutting room floor that goes into the book or doesn't go into the book. And this one I sort of chose to leave where it was.
To me, it seemed like just in the oral tradition, there's more room and there's more freedom to have that spiritual consciousness or have that shamanic consciousness that allows for expansion. And I don't know if the written word actually starts consolidating or perhaps putting something in a box. I don't know. I never really thought about it until reading this book, but I think it's really a valid point to really enhance or give real true meaning to that oral tradition.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. You know, there's been so many debates over the decades among anthropologists and archaeologists and historians. The weight of oral histories, the veracity of them. There's a number of stories in this book that touch on whether it's oral histories in the case of the griots in West Africa or just things being passed down only orally and then things that were never written down, whether it's a recipe, a formula, a technique. It's such an interesting topic. Oftentimes, the people who have this patented formula, it's a way to preserve things within your own family, if that's a tradition or a wish among a custodian. It also makes the traditions themselves a little bit more perilous. When something isn't written down, it's harder necessarily to document and to spread that beyond those within kind of close proximity to you, if that's something a custodian wishes to do. So it's a very interesting debate. It's something that I think, for those who might read the book, you'll see that certain custodians, certain traditions, some people have chosen to break with tradition and maybe to write things down for the first time or to take something that was only passed down orally from one member of a family to another and bring that outside of the family. It's tough to say, but I think one of my favorite examples of this is in the first chapter where it's this 27th generation griot, which is kind of a storyteller, a bard, if you will, in medieval Africa. And so much of what we know about the Mali Empire, which was the greatest civilization in West African history, comes from this unbroken line of oral storytellers. And for so long, Western anthropologists and archaeologists would kind of snub this tradition and not give it necessarily the weight that something else that was written down might have. But time and time again, archaeologists who are working in that area will interview these griots and listen to their stories and then use that as a basis of where to dig. And 9 times out of 10, what they find when they do dig corroborates the stories that have been passed down. So I think we're getting to a point now where oral histories, oral traditions are getting a sense of recognition and respect that maybe in the past they didn't.
Here we go again. The science comes through, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. In the case of these different people that you've been with and have written about, are they just doing their thing and then you come along? Do they become more aware of holding a tradition and it's very important to them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I have found that the people who are doing this work do this work because they love the work. There's often a kind of a blurred line between where the custodian ends and where the tradition begins. They're very much one and the same, if that makes sense. But I think that oftentimes the worry about who will carry this on after this person exists from those who sort of depend on it, the ones who are not making the tradition themselves. And I use the example of the world's rarest pasta. Each of the stories in this book, it's not just about a mysterious metal mirror or this grass-woven Inca bridge that you might not cross or this pasta you're not going to taste. It's about kind of what these things mean and how communities are reliant on these traditions, whether they're aware of them or not. And so when you have these three aging women who are struggling to find successors for this sacred Threads of God pasta, as it's known, it's not just about who's going to replace them, but who is going to keep alive this way of life, this festival that kind of unites an entire island after they go.
Yes.
One of the people that I talked to said something to the effect of, we rely on these women's golden hands, and without them, there's no feast, there's no way of life that that this represents. So yeah. It's not about the tradition so much itself, but the broader picture. And a lot of the custodians that I've talked to just in one way or another let me know it's not really up to me. If someone wants to carry this on or not, I can control that to an extent, but I also can't. And one of the women who makes the pasta had a really haunting quote, which I still think about. She said, "So many beautiful things in this world that once were no longer are." And it's very true.
Yes, it is very true. Well, let me ask you this. Did you taste the pasta? Tell us about that.
I did. Yeah, I completed the overnight pilgrimage, walked 33 kilometers in the dark, and arrived at this rural sanctuary and received it in a bowl, kind of like communion. In fact, once you get it, the prior there greets you and with the steaming hot bowl and says, "For your devotion, may you be blessed by the threads of God." And you have it in a soup. Imagine eating a embroidered piece of lace that is incredibly thin with three overlapping layers that are kind of shaped diagonally. You make a big cylinder of it. You break it into kind of crude shards and you put it into the steaming hot bowl of broth soup filled with pecorino cheese and vegetables. It's incredibly fine. It's so thin that it sort of slides away from your spoon as you lift it up out of the bowl. And you really have to get the spoon just right in order to get the pasta. But that's kind of the beauty of this, right? It's the same three ingredients that go into that pasta as you would get in any supermarket on the shelf. Again, it's not so much that the pasta itself is extraordinary in terms of taste. The way you make it is clearly extraordinary. It's 256 razor-thin pieces of semolina wheat stretched with the tips of your fingertips. But the actual taste itself, it's pasta. It's just one of many examples of these beautiful, somewhat irrational things that people do because it's what we believe in, and that's what makes the world so interesting.
Right. And how did your writing or connection progress the more you met one more person on this path and really gave them the time and the attention to share what they had? How did you see your process in that?
I think my process in this book, first and foremost, is just to listen. There are a lot of travel books or whatever you want to classify this book, but there are a lot of books where I think the author inserts her or him or themselves in a way that doesn't always push the story forward. And so I just kind of wanted to use any sort of platform I had to fade into the background and to let the custodians and the communities that rely on them to sort of tell their own stories. Chances are most people have no idea about ancient metal mirror making in the state of Kerala or a tree in rural Germany that has its own mailing address. And so these are really things that I want the people who are closest to them to be able to express with their own words. Getting back to what we were saying earlier, so many of these cultures, when you go back into what we know of them, they didn't leave a written testimony of their own existence. And so what we know about them are from outsiders. We know about the Inca from Spanish conquistadors. We know about the Mali Empire, yes, from this oral line of griots, but also from North African and French colonists. And so I chose to not participate in that, and I wanted to let people tell their own stories.
Well, you did a great job in it. And obviously, I would love people to get a hold of this book and just take a moment, right? It's really dipping in your toe and then finding yourself all the way in the water and using your imagination and just being in the moment with all of these stories. But I love the German forest mail tree. Can you share what that's about?
Sure. I lived in Germany for quite a while and somehow found this story. In the northern reaches of Germany, there is a 500-year-old oak tree, and it is the only tree in the world that has its own mailing address. And for the last 130 years, 6 days a week, a German postal carrier has crunched through the forest, climbed a 6-foot-tall ladder, and stuffed handwritten love letters into the knot hole of this tree. And when this person does that, any person who's crunching through the forest and has their heart set on finding a partner can also climb the ladder and put their hand into this knot hole and read any of the letters that have been addressed to the tree. The rule is, if you find a letter that resonates with you, you're free to take it. If it doesn't, you put it back in. And through this ancient matchmaking service, this old Tinder that existed long before Tinder or any other online dating service, it's created more than 100 marriages. And I won't ruin it, but there is a twist in the story. It features the longest-serving mail carrier who served this tree, which is called the Bridegroom Oak, for about 20 years. And I'll just say that he had given up on love before he took this job, and that changes during the story.
Yes. I'm smiling. We have a town just north of Boulder called Loveland, and they accept all people sending their Valentines to be mailed from Loveland, Colorado.
That's nice.
Yeah. Not quite as romantic as the German forest, but...
Yeah, and, you know, again, similar to so many stories in the book, it's not so much about the tree. And this is something I felt very viscerally living in Germany. It's an exploration about what forests and trees mean to Germans. So many of German fairy tales, and you know, just maybe listening to me explain the story, you might think it sounds like a German fairy tale, but so many German fairy tales take place in the woods and in a language that has many lovely ways to express melancholy. Germans have one called Wald Einsamkeit, which means forest loneliness. And it's this idea of going into the forest by yourself and kind of losing yourself in the forest and finding someone or something bigger. And so all of this points back to the idea of how the Germans are forest people in their hearts. And a lot of German historians and experts and anthropologists will point to this. The very idea of the founding of Germany took place in the forest. So that's kind of how the story unravels, this very beautiful, almost fairy tale story as a way to speak more broadly about a people as a whole.
I think all of the stories, and that's the thread in the book, right? That all these stories really do lead us into, whether it's a craft or a cultural experience, that's how we're all formed. And when we can allow ourselves a conscious connection to all of this sort of thing, it only enhances our love and our existence.
Yeah, beautifully said. I agree.
Well, to bring us back into the world of today, what kind of projects are you working on now as a writer?
Well, I recently wrote a story about an island in Canada that has kind of become a national icon, but it's this tiny little island that you actually can't visit. You can see it from afar, but you can't visit it because the First Nations community that historically lived on the island has sealed it off from the world. So one of the only ways and the best way to see the island is by going on an overnight kayak trip, and that's what I did. But I'm a full-time editor here at the BBC, and so most of the stories that I work on is actually editing. But I would suspect there's probably another book in me somewhere. I just need to find the time to write and report one.
Wonderful. Elliot, thank you so much. I bet your strolls through Brooklyn now, you can probably sense where that person sweeping the street or the person roasting the coffee really is diving in deep. It's not just a chore.
Yeah, you know, so much of this process over the years has made me much more acutely aware of what makes a place a place, whether it's Brooklyn or Sardinia. What is it that makes the place distinct, that separates it from somewhere else? And I think that opening yourself to these individuals and being aware of who they are is meaningful.
Thank you for opening that door to wonder in your book, Custodians of Wonder, and also in your person.
Well, thank you so much. That's very kind of you to say.
Many thanks to Elliot Stein for being a custodian of wonder and for writing the book. For anything we do, find us at tributariesradio.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned and for wondering. It's a blessing.